Chapter 10. Make Them Dance. But here the morning's injured, weeping, and know why. Ramparts and souls have fallen. The will of the unjust has never lacked an engine. Still all princes must employ the fairly noble, unifying lie. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 11. 1. Economies of Action. The new power is action, a senior software engineer told me. The intelligence of the Internet of Things means that sensors can also be actuators. The director of the software engineering for a company that is an important player in the Internet of Things added, "It's no longer simply about ubiquitous computing. Now the real aim is ubiquitous intervention, action, and control. The real power is that now you can modify real-time actions in the real world. Connected smart sensors can register and analyze any kind of behavior, and then actually figure out how to change it. Real-time analytics translate into real-time action." The scientists and engineers I interviewed call this new capability actuation, and they describe it as the critical, though largely undiscussed, turning point in the evolution of the apparatus of ubiquity. This actuation capability defines a new phase of the prediction imperative that emphasizes economies of action. This phase represents the completion of the new means of behavior modification, a decisive and necessary evolution of the surveillance capitalist means of production toward a more complex, iterative, and muscular operational system. It is a critical achievement in the race toward guaranteed outcomes. Under surveillance capitalism, the objectives and operations of automated behavioral modification are designed and controlled by companies to meet their own revenue and growth objectives. As one senior engineer told me, "Sensors are used to modify people's behavior just as easily as they modify device behavior. There are many great things we can do with the Internet of Things, like lowering the heat in all the houses on your street so that the transformer is not overloaded, or optimizing an entire industrial operation. But at the individual level, it also means the power to take actions that can override what you are doing or even put you on a path you did not choose." The scientists and engineers whom I interviewed identified three key approaches to economies of action, each one aimed at achieving behavior modification. The first two I call tuning and herding. The third is already familiar as what behavioral psychologists refer to as conditioning. Strategies that produce economies of action vary according to the methods with which these approaches are combined and the salience of each. Tuning occurs in a variety of ways. It may involve subliminal cues designed to subtly shape the flow of behavior at the precise time and place for maximally efficient influence. Another kind of tuning involves what behavioral economists Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein call the nudge, which they define as any aspect of a choice architecture that alters people's behavior in a predictable way. The term choice architecture refers to the ways in which situations are already structured to channel attention and shape action. In some cases, these architectures are intentionally designed to elicit specific behavior, such as a classroom in which all the seats face the teacher, or an online business that requires you to click through many obscure pages in order to opt out of its tracking cookies. The use of this term is another way of saying, in behaviorist language, that social situations are always already thick with tuning interventions, most of which operate outside our awareness. Behavioral economists argue a worldview based on the notion that human mentation is frail and flawed, leading to irrational choices that fail to adequately consider the wider structure of alternatives. Thaler and Sunstein have encouraged governments to actively design nudges that adequately shepherd individual choice-making toward outcomes that align with their interests as perceived by experts. One classic example, favored by Thaler and Sunstein, is the cafeteria manager who nudges students to healthier food choices by prominently displaying the fruit salad in front of the pudding. Another is the automatic renewal of health insurance policies as a way of protecting individuals who overlook the need for new approvals at the end of each year. Surveillance capitalists adapted many of the highly contestable assumptions of behavioral economists as one cover story with which to legitimate their practical commitment to a unilateral commercial program of behavior modification. The twist here is that nudges are intended to encourage choices that accrue to the architect, not to the individual. The result is data scientists trained on economies of action who regard it as perfectly normal to master the art and science of the digital nudge for the sake of their company's commercial interests. For example, the chief data scientist for a national drugstore chain described how his company designs automatic digital nudges that subtly push people toward the specific behaviors favored by the company. You can make people do things with this technology. Even if it's just 5% of people, you've made 5% of people do an action they otherwise wouldn't have done. So, to some extent, there is an element of the user's loss of self-control. Herding is a second approach that relies on controlling key elements in a person's immediate context. The uncontract is an example of a herding technique. Shutting down a car's engine irreversibly changes the driver's immediate context, herding her out the car door. Herding enables remote orchestration of the human situation, foreclosing action alternatives, and thus moving behavior along a path of heightened probability that approximates certainty. We are learning how to write the music, and then we let the music make them dance, an Internet of Things software developer explains, adding, "We can engineer the context around a particular behavior and force change that way. Context-aware data allows us to tie together your emotions, your cognitive functions, your vital signs, etc. We can know if you shouldn't be driving, and we can just shut your car down. We can tell the fridge, hey, lock up because he shouldn't be eating. Or we tell the TV to shut off and make you get some sleep. Or the chair to start shaking because you shouldn't be sitting so long. Or the faucet to turn on because you need to drink more water." Conditioning is a well-known approach to inducing behavior change, primarily associated with the famous Harvard behaviorist B.F. Skinner. He argued that behavior modification should mimic the evolutionary process, in which naturally occurring behaviors are selected for success by environmental conditions. Instead of the earlier, more simplistic model of stimulus-response associated with behaviorists such as Watson and Pavlov, Skinner interpolated a third variable, reinforcement. In his laboratory work with mice and pigeons, Skinner learned how to observe a range of naturally occurring behaviors in the experimental animal, and then reinforce the specific action, or operant, that he wanted the animal to reproduce. Ultimately, he mastered intricate designs or schedules of reinforcement that could reliably shape precise behavioral routines. Skinner called the application of reinforcements to shape specific behaviors operant conditioning. His larger project was known as behavior modification or behavioral engineering, in which behavior is continuously shaped to amplify some actions at the expense of others. In the end, the pigeon learns, for example, to peck a button twice in order to receive a pellet of grain. The mouse learns his way through a complicated maze and back again. Skinner imagined a pervasive technology of behavior that would enable the application of such methods across entire human populations. As the chief data scientist for a much-admired Silicon Valley education company told me, "Conditioning at scale is essential to the new science of massively engineered human behavior." He believes that smartphones, wearable devices, and the larger assembly of always-on networked nodes allow his company to modify and manage a substantial swath of its users' behavior. As digital signals monitor and track a person's daily activities, the company gradually masters the schedule of reinforcements, rewards, recognition, or praise that can reliably produce the specific user behaviors that the company selects for dominance. The goal of everything we do is to change people's actual behavior at scale. We want to figure out the construction of changing a person's behavior, and then we want to change how lots of people are making their day-to-day decisions. When people use our app, we can capture their behaviors and identify good and bad ones. Then we develop treatments or data pellets that select good behaviors. We can test how actionable our cues are for them and how profitable certain behaviors are for us. Although it is still possible to imagine automated behavioral modification without surveillance capitalism, it is not possible to imagine surveillance capitalism without the marriage of behavior modification and the technological means to automate its application. This marriage is essential to economies of action. For example, one can imagine a fitness tracker, a car, or a refrigerator whose data and operational controls are accessible exclusively to their owners for the purposes of helping them to exercise more often, drive safely, and eat healthily. But as we have already seen in so many domains, the rise of surveillance capitalism has obliterated the idea of the simple feedback loop characteristic of the behavioral value reinvestment cycle. In the end, it's not the devices. It's Max Weber's economic orientation, now determined by surveillance capitalism. The allure of surveillance revenues drives the continuous accumulation of more and more predictive forms of behavioral surplus. The most predictive source of all is behavior that has already been modified to orient toward guaranteed outcomes. The fusion of new digital means of modification and new economic aims produces whole new ranges of techniques for creating and cornering these new forms of surplus. A study called Behavior Change Implemented in Electronic Lifestyle Activity Monitors is illustrative. Researchers from the University of Texas and the University of Central Florida studied 13 such applications, concluding that the monitoring devices contain a wide range of behavior change techniques typically used in clinical behavior interventions. The researchers conclude that behavior change operations are proliferating as a result of their migration to digital devices and internet connectivity. They note that the very possibility of a simple loop designed by and for the consumer seems hopelessly elusive, observing that behavior change apps lend themselves to various types of surveillance, and that official methods of securely and simply transmitting data do not appear to currently exist in these apps. Remember that Google economist Hal Varian extolled the new uses of big data that proceed from ubiquitous computer-mediated transactions. Among these, he included the opportunity for continuous experimentation. Varian noted that Google has its engineering and data science teams consistently running thousands of A/B experiments that rely on randomization and controls to test user reactions to hundreds of variations in page characteristics, from layout to buttons to fonts. Varian endorsed and celebrated this self-authorizing experimental role, warning that all the data in the world can only measure correlation, not causality. Data tell what happened, but not why it happened. In the absence of casual knowledge, even the best predictions are only extrapolations from the past. The result of this conundrum is that the last crucial element in the construction of high-quality prediction products, that is, those that approximate guaranteed outcomes, depends upon casual knowledge. As Varian says, if you really want to understand causality, you have to run experiments. And if you run experiments continuously, you can continuously improve your system. Because the system is intended to produce predictions, Continuously improving the system means closing the gap between prediction and observation in order to approximate certainty. In an analog world, such ambitions would be far too expensive to be practical. But Varian observes that, in the realm of the internet, experimentation can be entirely automated. Varian awards surveillance capitalists the privilege of the experimenter's role, and this is presented as another casual fait accompli. In fact, it reflects the final critical step in surveillance capitalists' radical self-dealing of new rights. In this phase of the prediction imperative, surveillance capitalists declare their right to modify others' behavior for profit according to methods that bypass human awareness, individual decision rights, and the entire complex of self-regulatory processes that we summarize with terms such as autonomy and self-determination. What follows now are two distinct narratives of surveillance capitalists as experimenters who leverage their asymmetries of knowledge to impose their will on the unsuspecting human subjects who are their users. The experimental insights accumulated through their one-way mirrors are critical to constructing, fine-tuning, and exploring the capabilities of each firm's for-profit means of behavioral modification. In Facebook's user experiments and in the augmented reality game Pokemon Go, imagined and incubated at Google, we see the commercial means of behavioral modification evolving before our eyes. Both combine the components of economies of action and the techniques of tuning, herding, and conditioning in startling new ways that expose the Greeks secreted deep in the belly of the Trojan horse, the economic orientation obscured behind the veil of the digital. 2. Facebook writes the music. In 2012, Facebook researchers startled the public with an article provocatively titled, "A 61 Million Person Experiment in Social Influence and Political Mobilization," published in the scientific journal Nature. In this controlled, randomized study, conducted during the run-up to the 2010 U.S. congressional midterm elections, the researchers experimentally manipulated the social and informational content of voting-related messages in the news feeds of nearly 61 million Facebook users, while also establishing a control group. One group was shown a statement at the top of their news feed encouraging the user to vote. It included a link to polling place information, an actionable button reading, "I voted," a counter indicating how many other Facebook users reported voting, and up to 6 profile pictures of the user's Facebook friends who had already clicked the "I voted" button. A second group received the same information, but without the pictures of friends. A third control group did not receive any special message. The results showed that users who received the social message were about 2% more likely to click on the "I voted" button than did those who received the information alone, and 0.26% more likely to click on polling place information. The Facebook experimenters determined that social messaging was an effective means of tuning behavior at scale, because it directly influenced political self-expression, information-seeking, and real-world voting behavior of millions of people. And they concluded that showing familiar faces to users can dramatically improve the effectiveness of a mobilization message. The team calculated that the manipulated social messages sent 60,000 additional voters to the polls in the 2010 midterm elections, as well as another 280,000 who cast votes as a result of a social contagion effect, for a total of 340,000 additional votes. In their concluding remarks, the researchers asserted that, "We show the importance of social influence for affecting behavior change. The results suggest that online messages might influence a variety of offline behaviors, and this has implications for our understanding of the role of online social media in society." The experiment succeeded by producing social cues that suggested or primed users in ways that tuned their real-world behavior toward a specific set of actions determined by the experimenters. In this process of experimentation, economies of action are discovered, honed, and ultimately institutionalized in software programs and their algorithms that function automatically, continuously, ubiquitously, and pervasively to achieve economies of action. Facebook's surplus is aimed at solving one problem: how and when to intervene in the state of play that is your daily life in order to modify your behavior and thus sharply increase the predictability of your actions now, soon, and later. The challenge for surveillance capitalists is to learn how to do this effectively, automatically, and therefore economically, as a former Facebook product manager writes. Experiments are run on every user at some point in their tenure on the site, whether that is seeing different size ad copy, or different marketing messages, or different call-to-action buttons, or having their feeds generated by different ranking algorithms. The fundamental purpose of most people at Facebook working on data is to influence and alter people's moods and behavior. They are doing it all the time to make you like stories more, to click on more ads, to spend more time on the site. This is just how a website works. Everyone does this, and everyone knows that everyone does this. The Facebook Studies publication evoked fierce debate as experts and the wider public finally began to reckon with Facebook's and the other internet companies' unprecedented power to persuade, influence, and ultimately manufacture behavior. Harvard's Jonathan Zittrain, a specialist in internet law, acknowledged that it was now possible to imagine Facebook quietly engineering an election, using means that its users could neither detect nor control. He described the Facebook experiment as a challenge to collective rights that could undermine the right of people as a whole to enjoy the benefits of a democratic process. Public concern failed to destabilize Facebook's self-authorizing practice of behavior modification at scale. Even as the social influence experiment was being debated in 2012, a Facebook data scientist was already collaborating with academic researchers on a new study: experimental evidence of massive-scale emotional contagion through social networks, submitted to the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2013, where it was edited by a well-known Princeton social psychologist, Susan Fiske, and published in June 2014. This time, the experimenters manipulated the extent to which people, N equals 689,003, were exposed to emotional expressions in their newsfeed. The experiment was structured like one of those allegedly benign A-B tests. In this case, one group was exposed to mostly positive messages in their newsfeed, and the other to predominantly negative messages. The idea was to test whether even subliminal exposure to specific emotional content would cause people to change their own posting behavior to reflect that content. It did. Whether or not users felt happier or sadder, the tone of their expression changed to reflect their newsfeed. The experimental results left no doubt that, once again, Facebook's carefully designed, undetectable, and uncontestable subliminal cues reached beyond the screen into the daily lives of hundreds of thousands of naive users, predictably actuating specific qualities of emotional expression through processes that operate outside the awareness of their human targets, just as Stuart McKay had originally prescribed for Galapagos turtles and Canadian elk. Refer to Chapter 7. Emotional states can be transferred to others via emotional contagion, leading people to experience the same emotions without their awareness, the researchers proclaimed. Online messages influence our experience of emotions, which may affect a variety of offline behaviors. The team celebrated its work as some of the first experimental evidence to support the controversial claims that emotions can spread throughout a network, and they reflected on the fact that even their relatively minimal manipulation had a measurable effect, albeit a small one. What Facebook researchers failed to acknowledge in either experiment is that a person's susceptibility to subliminal cues and his or her vulnerability to a contagion effect is largely dependent upon empathy, the ability to understand and share in the mental and emotional state of another person, including feeling another's feelings and being able to take another's point of view, sometimes characterized as affective or cognitive empathy. Psychologists have found that the more a person can project himself or herself into the feelings of another and take the other's perspective, the more likely he or she is to be influenced by subliminal cues, including hypnosis. Empathy orients people toward other people. It allows one to get absorbed in emotional experience and to resonate with others' experiences, including unconsciously mimicking another's facial expressions or body language. Contagious laughing and even contagious yawning are examples of such resonance. Empathy is considered essential to social bonding and emotional attachment, but it can also trigger vicarious anxiety for victims or others who are genuinely distressed. Some psychologists have called empathy a risky strength because it predisposes us to experience others' happiness, but also their pain. The successful tuning evident in both Facebook experiments is the result of the effective exploitation of the natural empathy present in its population of users. The Facebook researchers claimed that the results suggested two inferences. First, in a massive and engaged population such as Facebook users, even small effects can have large aggregated consequences. Second, the authors invited readers to imagine what might be accomplished with more significant manipulations and larger experimental populations, noting the importance of their findings for public health. Once again, public outcry was substantial. If Facebook can tweak emotions and make us vote, what else can it do? The Guardian asked. The Atlantic quoted the study's editor, who had processed the article for publication despite her apparent misgivings. She told the magazine that, as a private company, Facebook did not have to adhere to the legal standards for experimentation required of academic and government researchers. These legal standards are known as the Common Rule. Designed to protect against the abuse of the experimenter's power, these standards must be adhered to by all federally funded research. The Common Rule enforces procedures for informed consent, avoidance of harm, debriefing, and transparency, and it is administered by panels of scientists known as internal review boards, appointed within every research institution. Fisk acknowledged that she had been persuaded by Facebook's argument that the experimental manipulation was an unremarkable extension of the corporation's standard practice of manipulating people's news feeds. As Fisk recounted, they said that Facebook apparently manipulates people's news feeds all the time. Who knows what other research they're doing? In other words, Fisk recognized that the experiment was merely an extension of Facebook's standard practices of behavioral modification, which already flourish without sanction. Facebook data scientist and principal researcher Adam Kramer was deluged with hundreds of media queries, leading him to write on his Facebook page that the corporation really does care about its emotional impact. One of his co-authors, Cornell's Jeffrey Hancock, told the New York Times that he didn't realize that manipulating the news feeds, even modestly, would make some people feel violated. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Facebook Data Science Group had run more than 1,000 experiments since its inception in 2007 and operated with few limits and no internal review board. Writing in The Guardian, psychology professor Chris Chambers summarized that the Facebook study paints a dystopian future in which academic researchers escape ethical restriction by teaming up with private companies to test increasingly dangerous or harmful interventions. A month after the emotional contagion study's publication, The editor-in-chief of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Inder M. Verma, published an editorial expression of concern regarding the Facebook research. After acknowledging the standard defense that Facebook is technically exempt from the common rule, Verma added, "It is nevertheless a matter of concern that the collection of the data by Facebook may have involved practices that were not fully consistent with the principles of obtaining informed consent and allowing participants to opt out." Among U.S. scholars, University of Maryland law professor James Grimmelman published the most comprehensive argument in favor of holding Facebook and other social media companies accountable to the standards represented by the common rule. Corporate research is more likely than academic research to be compromised by serious conflicts of interests, he reasoned, making common experimental standards critical and not something to be left to individual ethical judgment. Grimmelman imagined internal review board laundering in which academics could circumvent research ethics regulations whenever they work just closely enough with industry partners. The exception would swallow the common rule. Despite his conviction on this point, Grimmelman acknowledged in the final pages of his analysis that even the most rigorous imposition of the common rule would do little to curb the immense power of a company such as Facebook that routinely manipulates user behavior at scale, using means that are indecipherable and therefore uncontestable. Like Fisk, Grimmelman sensed the larger project of economies of action just beyond the reach of established law and social norms. The journal Nature drew attention with a strongly worded letter defending the Facebook experiment, authored by bioethicist Michelle Meyer, together with 5 co-authors, and on behalf of 27 other ethicists. The letter argued that the need to codify new knowledge about the online environment justifies experimentation even when it does not or cannot abide by accepted ethical guidelines for human subjects research. But Meyer's defense turned on a prescient note of warning that the extreme response to this study could result in such research being done in secret. If critics think that the manipulation of emotional content in this research is sufficiently concerning to merit regulation, then the same concern must apply to Facebook's standard practice. The experiment's critics and supporters agreed on little but this. Facebook could easily turn rogue, threatening to retreat to secrecy if regulators attempted to intervene in its practices. The academic community shared a sense of threat in the face of known facts. Facebook owns an unprecedented means of behavior modification that operates covertly, at scale, and in the absence of social or legal mechanisms of agreement, contest, and control. Even the most stringent application of the common rule would be unlikely to change these facts. As scholars promised to convene panels to consider the ethical issues raised by Facebook research, the corporation announced its own plans for better self-regulation. The corporation's chief technology officer, Mike Schrepfer, confessed to being unprepared for the public reaction to the emotional contagion study, and he admitted that there are things we should have done differently. The company's new framework for research included clear guidelines, an internal review panel, a capsule on research practices incorporated into the company's famous boot camp orientation and training program for new hires, and a website to feature published academic research. These self-imposed regulations did not challenge the fundamental facts of Facebook's online community as the necessary developmental environment and target for the firm's economies of action. A document acquired by the Australian Press in May 2017 would eventually reveal this fact. 3 years after the publication of the contagion study, the Australian broke the story on a confidential 23-page Facebook document written by 2 Facebook executives in 2017 and aimed at the company's Australian and New Zealand advertisers. The report depicted the corporation's systems for gathering psychological insights on 6.4 million high school and tertiary students, as well as young Australians and New Zealanders already in the workforce. The Facebook document detailed the many ways in which the corporation uses its stores of behavioral surplus to pinpoint the exact moment at which a young person needs a confidence boost and is therefore most vulnerable to a specific configuration of advertising cues and nudges. By monitoring posts, pictures, interactions, and internet activity, Facebook can work out when young people feel stressed, defeated, overwhelmed, anxious, nervous, stupid, silly, useless, and a failure. The report reveals Facebook's interest in leveraging this effective surplus for the purpose of economies of action. It boasts detailed information on mood shifts among young people based on internal Facebook data, and it claims that Facebook's prediction products can not only detect sentiment, but also predict how emotions are communicated at different points during the week, matching each emotional phase with appropriate ad messaging for the maximum probability of guaranteed outcomes. Anticipatory emotions are more likely to be expressed early in the week, the analysis counsels, while reflective emotions increase on the weekend. Monday through Thursday is about building confidence. The weekend is for broadcasting achievements. Facebook publicly denied these practices, but Antonio Garcia Martinez, a former Facebook product manager and author of a useful account of Silicon Valley titled Chaos Monkeys, described in The Guardian the routine application of such practices and accused the corporation of lying through their teeth. He concluded, "The hard reality is that Facebook will never try to limit such use of their data unless the public uproar reaches such a crescendo as to be unmutable." Certainly, the public challenge to Facebook's insertion of itself into the emotional lives of its users, as expressed in the contagion study, and its pledge to self-regulate, did not quell its commercial interest in users' emotions, or the corporation's compulsion to systematically exploit that knowledge on behalf of and in collaboration with its customers. It did not, because it cannot. Not as long as the company's revenues are bound to economies of action under the authority of the prediction imperative. Facebook's persistence warns us against the dispossession cycle's stubborn march. Facebook had publicly acknowledged and apologized for its overt experimental incursions into behavior modification and emotional manipulation, and it promised adaptations to curb or mitigate these practices. Meanwhile, a new threshold of intimate life had been breached. Facebook's potential mastery of emotional manipulation became discussable and even taken for granted as habituation set in. From Princeton's Fisk to critic Grimmelman and supporter Meyer, the experts believe that if Facebook's activities were to be forced into a new regulatory regime, the corporation would merely continue in secret. The Australian documents opened one door on these covert practices, suggesting the completion of the cycle with the redirection of action into clandestine zones protected by opacity and indecipherability, just as these scholars had anticipated. Facebook's political mobilization experimenters discovered that they could manipulate users' vulnerabilities to social influence in order to create a motivational condition, "I want to be like my friends," that increases the probability that a relevant priming message, the "I voted" button, will produce action. The emotional contagion study exploited the same underlying social influence orientation. In this case, Facebook planted subliminal cues in the form of positive or negative affective language, which combined with the motivational state triggered by social comparison, "I want to be like my friends," to produce a measurable, if weak, contagion effect. Finally, the Australian ad targeting document points to the seriousness and complexity of the backstage effort to strengthen this effect by specifying motivational conditions at a granular level. It reveals not only the scale and scope of Facebook's behavioral surplus, but also the corporation's interest in leveraging its surplus to precisely determine the ebb and flow of a user's predisposition for real-time targeting by the branded cues that are most likely to achieve guaranteed outcomes. Facebook's experimental success demonstrates that tuning through suggestion can be an effective form of telestimulation at scale. The evasion of individual and group awareness was critical to Facebook's behavior modification success, just as McKay had stipulated. The first paragraph of the research article on emotional contagion celebrates this evasion. Emotional states can be transferred to others via emotional contagion, leading people to experience the same emotions without their awareness. Nor do the young adults of Australia's great cities suspect that the precise measure of their fears and fantasies is exploited for commercial result at the hour and moment of their greatest vulnerability. This evasion is neither accidental nor incidental, but actually essential to the structure of the whole surveillance capitalist project. Individual awareness is the enemy of telestimulation because it is the necessary condition for the mobilization of cognitive and existential resources. There is no autonomous judgment without awareness. Agreement and disagreement, participation and withdrawal, resistance or collaboration. None of these self-regulating choices can exist without awareness. A rich and flourishing research literature illuminates the antecedents, conditions, consequences, and challenges of human self-regulation as a universal need. The capacity for self-determination is understood as an essential foundation for many of the behaviors that we associate with critical capabilities such as empathy, volition, reflection, personal development, authenticity, integrity, learning, goal accomplishment, impulse control, creativity, and the sustenance of intimate, enduring relationships. Implicit in this process is a self that sets goals and standards, is aware of its own thoughts and behaviors, and has the capacity to change them, write Ohio State University professor Dylan Wagner and Dartmouth professor Todd Heatherton in an essay about the centrality of self-awareness to self-determination. Indeed, some theorists have suggested that the primary purpose of self-awareness is to enable self-regulation. Every threat to human autonomy begins with an assault on awareness, tearing down our capacity to regulate our thoughts, emotions, and desires. The salience of self-awareness as a bulwark against self-regulatory failure is also underscored in the work of two Cambridge University researchers who developed a scale to measure a person's susceptibility to persuasion. They found that the single most important determinant of one's ability to resist persuasion is what they call the ability to premeditate. This means that the people who harness self-awareness to think through the consequences of their actions are more disposed to chart their own course and are significantly less vulnerable to persuasion techniques. Self-awareness also figures in the second highest ranking factor on their scale, commitment. People who are consciously committed to a course of action or set of principles are less likely to be persuaded to do something that violates that commitment. We have seen already that democracy threatens surveillance revenues. Facebook's practices suggest an equally disturbing conclusion. Human consciousness itself is a threat to surveillance revenues, as awareness endangers the larger project of behavior modification. Philosophers recognize self-regulation, self-determination, and autonomy as freedom of will. The word autonomy derives from the Greek and literally means regulation by the self. It stands in contrast to heteronomy, which means regulation by others. The competitive necessity of economies of action means that surveillance capitalists must use all means available to supplant autonomous action with heteronomous action. In one sense, there is nothing remarkable in observing that capitalists would prefer individuals who agree to work and consume in ways that most advantage capital. We need only to consider the ravages of the subprime mortgage industry that helped trigger the great financial crisis of 2008, or the daily insults to human autonomy at the hands of countless industries, from airlines to insurance, for plentiful examples of this plain fact. However, it would be dangerous to nurse the notion that today's surveillance capitalists simply represent more of the same. This structural requirement of economies of action turns the means of behavioral modification into an engine of growth. At no other time in history have private corporations of unprecedented wealth and power enjoyed the free exercise of economies of action supported by a pervasive global architecture of ubiquitous computational knowledge and control, constructed and maintained by all the advanced scientific know-how that money can buy. Most pointedly, Facebook's declaration of experimental authority claims surveillance capitalists' prerogatives over the future course of others' behavior. In declaring the right to modify human action secretly and for profit, surveillance capitalism effectively exiles us from our own behavior, shifting the locus of control over the future tense from I will to you will. Each one of us may follow a distinct path, but economies of action ensure that the path is already shaped by surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives. The struggle for power and control in society is no longer associated with the hidden facts of class and its relationship to production, but rather by the hidden facts of automated engineered behavior modification. 3. Pokemon Go. Do. It had been a particularly grueling July afternoon in 2016. David had directed hours of contentious insurance testimony in a dusty New Jersey courtroom where a power surge the night before had knocked out the building's fragile air conditioning system. Then the fitful Friday commute home was cursed by a single car disabled by the heat that turned the once hopeful flow of traffic into sludge. Finally home, he slid the car into his garage and made a beeline for the side door that opened to the laundry room and kitchen beyond. The cool air hit him like a dive into the ocean, and for the first time all day, he took a deep breath. A note on the table said his wife would be back in a few minutes. He gulped down some water, made himself a drink, and climbed the stairs, heading for a long shower. The doorbell rang just as the warm water hit his aching back muscles. Had she forgotten her key? Shower interrupted, he threw on a tee and shorts and ran downstairs, opening the front door to a couple of teenagers waving their cell phones in his face. "Hey, you've got a Pokemon in your backyard. It's ours. Okay if we go back there and catch it?" "A what?" He had no idea what they were talking about, but he was about to get educated. David's doorbell rang four more times that evening. Perfect strangers, eager for access to his yard, and disgruntled when he asked them to leave. Throughout the days and evenings that followed, knots of Pokemon seekers formed on his front lawn, some of them young, and others long past that excuse. They held up their phones, pointing and shouting as they scanned his house and garden for the augmented reality creatures. Looking at this small slice of world through their phones, they could see their Pokemon prey, but only at the expense of everything else. They could not see a family's home or the boundaries of civility that made it a sanctuary for the man and woman who lived there. Instead, the game seized the house and the world around it, reinterpreting all of it in a vast equivalency of GPS coordinates. Here was a new kind of commercial assertion. A for-profit declaration of eminent domain in which reality is recast as an unbounded expanse of blank spaces to be sweated for others' enrichment. David wondered, when will this end? What gives them the right? Whom do I call to make this stop? Without knowing it, he had been yanked from his shower to join the villagers in Broughton, England, who had taken to their streets in 2009, protesting the invasion of Google's Street View camera cars. Like them, he had been abruptly thrust into contest with surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives, and like them, he would soon understand that there was no number to call, no 911 to urgently inform the appropriate authorities that a dreadful mistake had blossomed on his lawn. Back in 2009, as we saw in Chapter 5, Google Maps product vice president and Street View boss John Hankey ignored the Broughton protesters, insisting that only he and Google knew what was best, not just for Broughton, but for all people. Now here was Hankey again at surveillance capitalism's next frontier, This time, as the founder of the company behind Pokemon Go, Niantic Labs. Hanky, you may recall, nursed an abiding determination to own the world by mapping it. He had founded Keyhole, the satellite mapping startup funded by the CIA and later acquired by Google and rechristened as Google Earth. At Google, he was a vice president for Google Maps and a principal in its controversial push to commandeer public and private space through its Street View project. Hanky recounts that Pokemon Go was born out of Google Maps, which also supplied most of the game's original development team. Indeed, Street View's mystery engineer, Marius Milner, had joined Hanky in this new phase of incursion. By 2010, Hanky had set up his own launch pad, Niantic Labs, inside the Google mothership. His aim was the development of parallel reality games that would track and herd people through the very territories that Street View had so audaciously claimed for its maps. In 2015, following the establishment of the Alphabet corporate structure, and well after the development of Pokemon Go, Niantic Labs was formally established as an independent company with $30 million in funding from Google, Nintendo, the Japanese company that originally hosted Pokemon on its Game Boy devices in the late 1990s, and the Pokemon Company. Hanky had long recognized the power of the game format as a means to achieve economies of action. While still at Google, he told an interviewer, "More than 80% of people who own a mobile device claim that they play games on their device. Games are often the number one or number two activity. So for Android as an operative system, but also for Google, we think it's important for us to innovate and to be a leader in the future of mobile gaming." It is worth noting that Hanky chose to name his group after a 19th century merchant sailing vessel undone by greed. The Niantic had been sold and repurposed for the more lucrative whaling trade when it set sail for San Francisco and the Northern Pacific Whaling Grounds in 1849. The ship's captain made an unplanned stop in Panama to board hundreds of pilgrims bound for the California Gold Rush, all of them eager to pay top dollar for cramped, smelly quarters on the whaler. The captain's avarice proved fatal to the ship's prospects when those passengers infected the ship's crew with gold fever. The sailors abandoned captain and vessel upon docking in San Francisco, heading instead for gold country. Unable to continue the journey, the captain was forced to sell the ship for a pittance, leaving it wedged deep in the sandy shallows at the foot of Clay and Montgomery Streets. In 2016, Hanky took up the quest of that rebellious crew. His Niantic was bound for a new century's gold rush at the frontier of the prediction imperative's next wave of conquest, economies of action. Hanky's Pokemon Go launched in July 2016 as a different answer to the question confronting the engineers and scientists shaping the surveillance capitalist project. How can human behavior be actuated quickly and at scale while driving it toward guaranteed outcomes? At its zenith in the summer of 2016, Pokemon Go was a surveillance capitalist's dream come true, fusing scale, scope, and actuation, yielding continuous sources of behavioral surplus, and providing fresh data to elaborate the mapping of interior, exterior, public, and private spaces. Most important, it provided a living laboratory for telestimulation at scale as the game's owners learned how to automatically condition and herd collective behavior, directing it toward real-time constellations of behavioral futures markets. With all of this accomplished just beyond the rim of individual awareness. In Hanky's approach, economies of action would be achieved through the dynamics of a game. Niantic designed the new game to be played in the real world, not on a screen. The idea is that players should be going outside for adventures on foot in the open spaces of cities, towns, and suburbs. The game relies on augmented reality and is structured like a treasure hunt. Once you download the app from Niantic, you use GPS and your smartphone camera to hunt virtual creatures called Pokemon. The figures appear on your smartphone screen as if they are located beside you in your real-life surroundings. an unsuspecting man's backyard, a city street, a pizzeria, a park, a drugstore. Captured Pokemon are rewarded with game currencies, candies, and stardust, and are employed to battle other users. The ultimate goal is to capture a comprehensive array of the 151 Pokemon, but along the way, players can earn experience points, rising to successive levels of expertise. At level 5, players can join one of three teams to battle Pokemon at designated sites referred to as gyms. The ramp-up had begun years earlier with Ingress, Niantic's first mobile game designed for real-world play. Released in 2012, Ingress was a precursor and testbed for the capabilities and methods that would define Pokemon Go. The game drove its users through their cities and towns to find and control designated portals and capture territory, as the game masters relied on GPS to track users' movements and map the territories through which they roamed. Hanke reflected on what he and his team had learned from Ingress. Most important was the Niantic team's surprise as they observed how much the behavior of the players changes. Hanke grasped that the seeds of behavior modification were planted in the game's rules and social dynamic. If you want to turn the world into your game board, the places you want people to interact with have to have certain characteristics. There should be a reason for the player to go there. The game is enabling them and nudging you to have those interactions. One user, whose Ingress name was Spottiswood, provides an example. As I cycle home, I stop near a location I'd scouted out previously, one with a weak enemy portal. I attack, using built-up XM, exotic matter, to destroy the enemy infrastructure. On Ingress's built-in chat client, a player called Igashu praises my handiwork. "Good job, Spottiswood," he says. I feel proud and move on, plotting my next assault upon the enemy's portals. According to Hanke, Pokemon Go would be designed to leverage what the team now understood as the key sources of motivation that induce players to change their behavior: a social gaming community based on real-world action. All games circumscribe behavior with rules, rewarding some forms of action and punishing others, and Niantic is not the first to employ the structure of a game as a means of effecting behavior change in its players. Indeed, gamification as an approach to behavioral engineering is a subject of intense interest that has produced a robust academic and popular literature. According to Wharton professor Kevin Werbach, games include three tiers of action. At the highest level are the dynamics that drive the motivational energy of the game. These can be emotions aroused by competition or frustration, a compelling narrative, a structure of progression that creates the experience of development toward a higher goal, or relationships that produce feelings such as team spirit or aggression. Next are the mechanics. These are the procedural building blocks that drive the action and also build engagement. For example, a game may be structured as a competition or a solo challenge, as turn-taking and cooperation, as transactions and winner-take-all, as team sport or individual conquest. Finally, there are the game components that operationalize the mechanics. These are the most visible aspects of a game: points to represent progress, quests laid out as predefined challenges, badges to represent achievements, leaderboards to visually display all players' progress, boss fights to mark the culmination of a level, and so forth. Most research on games concludes that these structures can be effective at motivating action, and researchers generally predict that games will increasingly be used as the methodology of choice to change individual behavior. In practice, this has meant that the power of games to change behavior is shamelessly instrumentalized as gamification spreads to thousands of situations in which a company merely wants to tune, herd, and condition the behavior of its customers or employees toward its own objectives. Typically, this involves importing a few components, such as reward points and levels of advancement, in order to engineer behaviors that serve the company's immediate interests with programs such as customer loyalty schemes or internal sales competitions. One analyst compiled a survey of more than 90 such gamification cases, complete with return on investment statistics. Ian Bogost, a professor of interactive computing at Georgia Tech and a digital culture observer, insists that these systems should be called exploitation-ware rather than games because their sole aim is behavior manipulation and modification. Pokemon Go takes these capabilities in a wholly new direction, running game players through the real world, but not for the sake of the game they think they are playing. Hankey's unique genius is to point the game's behavior modification efforts toward a target that occupies an unexplored zone beyond the boundaries of players' awareness. It aims to shape behavior even in a larger game of surveillance capitalism. Pokemon Go was first unveiled to the Wall Street Journal in September 2015, shortly after Niantic's spin-off from Google. The game masters told the reporter that the game would not include ads. Instead, revenues would accrue from microtransactions, presumably in-game purchases of virtual paraphernalia, although Niantic declined to say exactly what would be for sale. Niantic also promised a location tracking bracelet that vibrates and lights up when a person approaches a Pokemon. It was clear that Pokemon Go would at least be a fresh source of surplus for refining and expanding the maps upon which the game depended. Released in the US, Australia, and New Zealand on July 6, 2016, Pokemon Go became the most downloaded and highest-grossing app in the US within only a week, quickly achieving as many active Android users as Twitter. More than 60% of the app's downloads were in daily use, and by July 8, that translated into a daily average of about 43.5 minutes per user. With Niantic's servers groaning under the strain, the game's European rollout was delayed until July 13th. By that time, however, Niantic had proved the value of its approach to economies of action, demonstrating unprecedented effectiveness in traversing that last tortured mile to guaranteed outcomes. The unprecedented pattern was faintly discernible within days of the game's launch. A Virginia bar offered a discount to a Pokemon Go team. A tea shop in San Francisco offered a buy one, get one free to the game's players. The owner of a pizza bar in Queens, New York, paid about $10 for lore modules, a bit of virtual game paraphernalia intended to attract Pokemon to a specific location, successfully producing virtual creatures on bar stools and in bathroom stalls. During the first weekend of gameplay, the bar's food and drink sales shot up by 30%, and later were reported to be 70% above average. Bloomberg reporters gushed that the game had achieved the retailer's elusive dream of using location tracking to drive foot traffic. It's easy to imagine a developer selling ads within the game world to local merchants, or even auctioning off the promise to turn specific shops and restaurants into destinations for players. Hankey hinted to the New York Times that these real-world, real-time markets had been the plan all along. Niantic has cut deals like that for Ingress, the paper reported, and Mr. Hankey said the company would announce sponsored locations for Pokemon Go in the future. The future came quickly. Within a week, the basic elements of surveillance capitalism's logic of accumulation were in place and were heralded as brilliant. As Hankey explained, the game relies on a lot of modern cell phone and data technology to power the augmented reality, but that traffic generated by the game also changes what happens in the real world. By July 12th, the Financial Times exulted that speculation has surged over the game's future power as a cash cow to retailers and other cravers of footfall. Nintendo shares were up 52%, adding $10.2 billion to its market capitalization. Earlier promises that the game would not serve ads turned out to be a technical claim that required careful parsing. In fact, the surveillance-based logic of online advertising had not disappeared. Rather, it had morphed into its physical world mirror image, just as Sidewalk Labs Dan Doktoroff had imagined for the Google City, a precise extension of the methods and purposes honed in the online world, but now amplified in reality under pressure from the prediction imperative. Refer to Chapter 7. By July 13th, Hanke admitted to the Financial Times that in addition to in-app payments for GameKit, there is a second component to our business model at Niantic, which is the concept of sponsored locations. He explained that this new revenue stream had always been in the plan, noting that companies will pay us to be locations within the virtual game board, the premise being that it is an inducement that drives foot traffic. These sponsors, Hanke explained, would be charged on a cost-per-visit basis, similar to the cost-per-click used in Google's search advertising. The notion of sponsored locations is a euphemism for Niantic's behavioral futures markets, ground zero in Hanke's new gold rush. The elements and dynamics of the game, combined with its novel augmented reality technology, operate to herd populations of game players through the real-world monetization checkpoints constituted by the game's actual customers, the entities who pay to play on the real-world game board, lured by the promise of guaranteed outcomes. For a while, it seemed that everyone was making money. Niantic inked a deal with McDonald's to drive game users to its 30,000 Japanese outlets. A British mall owner commissioned recharging teams to roam his malls with portable rechargers for game users. Starbucks announced that it would join in with the fun, with 12,000 of its U.S. stores becoming official Pokestops, or gyms, along with a new Pokemon Go Frappuccino, the perfect treat for any Pokemon trainer on the go. Another deal with Sprint would convert 10,500 Sprint retail and service outlets into Pokemon hubs. The music streaming company Spotify reported a tripling of Pokemon-related music sales. A UK insurance company offered special coverage for mobile phones, warning, "Don't let accidental damage get in the way of catching them all." Disney admitted that it was disappointed with its own strategies for the blending of physical and digital to create new kinds of connected play experiences, and planned to transform its mammoth toy business in a direction similar to Pokemon Go. The zeal for Pokemon Go gradually diminished, but the impact of Hanke's accomplishments is indelible. "We've only just scratched the surface," Hanke told a crowd of fans. The game had demonstrated that it was possible to achieve economies of action on a global scale while simultaneously directing specific individual actions toward precise local market opportunities where high bidders enjoy an ever closer approximation of guaranteed outcomes. Niantic's distinctive accomplishment was to manage gamification as a way to guarantee outcomes for its actual customers, companies participating in the behavioral futures markets that it establishes and hosts. Hanke's game proved that surveillance capitalism could operate in the real world as much as it does in the virtual one, using its unilateral knowledge, scale, and scope to shape your behavior now, action, in order to more accurately predict your behavior later. The logical inference is that real-world revenues will increase in proportion to the company's ability to match persons with locations, just as Google learned to wield surplus as a means of targeting online ads to specific individuals. These requirements suggest that Niantic would conduct its operations in ways that establish substantial surplus supply chains aimed at scale and scope. Indeed, the company's surveillance policy signals its demand for behavioral data in excess of what is reasonable for effective game operations. Just 6 days after the game's release in July 2016, BuzzFeed reporter Joseph Bernstein advised Pokemon users to check how much data the app was collecting from their phones. According to his analysis, like most apps that work with the GPS in your smartphone, Pokemon Go can tell a lot of things about you based on your movement as you play, where you go, when you went there, how you got there, how long you stayed, and who else was there. And like many developers who build those apps, Niantic keeps that information. Whereas other location-based apps might collect similar data, Bernstein concluded that Pokemon Go's incredibly granular, block-by-block map data, combined with its surging popularity, may soon make it one of, if not the most detailed location-based social graphs ever compiled. The industry news site TechCrunch raised similar concerns regarding the game's data collection practices, questioning the long list of permissions the app requires. Those permissions included the camera, yes, but also permission to read your contacts and find accounts on device. Niantic's surveillance policy notes that it may share aggregated information and non-identifying information with third parties for research and analysis, demographic profiling, and other similar purposes. TechCrunch noted the game's precise location tracking and ability to perform audio fingerprinting through its access to your camera and microphone, concluding, "So it's prudent to expect some of your location data to end up in Google's hands." The Electronic Privacy Information Center noted in a letter of complaint to the Federal Trade Commission that Niantic had failed to provide compelling reasons for the scope of the information that it routinely gathers from users' phones and Google profiles. Nor had it set limits on how long it would retain, use, or share location data. As the letter concluded, there is no evidence that Niantic's collection and retention of location data is necessary to the function of the game, or otherwise provides a benefit to consumers that outweighs the privacy and safety harms it creates. By mid-July 2016, Niantic received a letter from U.S. Senator Al Franken querying the company's privacy practices. Niantic's late August response is instructive. A marvel of misdirection and secrecy that focuses on the game's mechanics and discloses nothing about its business model or the more comprehensive logic of accumulation behind the model. Pokemon Go has already been praised by public health officials, teachers, mental health workers, parents, park officials, and ordinary citizens around the world as an app that promotes healthy play and discovery. Though acknowledging the range of data it collects as a condition of play, location services, photos, media, files, camera, contacts, and network provider data, Niantic insists that data are used to provide and improve its services. However, it does not acknowledge that its services operate on two levels: game services for players and prediction services for Niantic's customers. The company concedes that it uses third-party services, including Google's, to collect and interpret data, but it is careful to sidestep the aims of those analyses. The 7-page letter mentions sponsored locations only once, noting that sponsors receive reports about visits and game actions. There is no reference to cost per visit or the surplus that will be required to drive that metric, in the same way that Google's cost per click depended upon behavioral surplus drawn from online activity. Niantic's self-presentation carefully conceals its objectives in the design and development of economies of action that drive real-world, real-time behavior toward Niantic's behavioral futures markets. The genius of Pokemon Go was to transform the game you see into a higher-order game of surveillance capitalism, a game about a game. The players who took the city as their board, roaming its parks and pizzerias, unwittingly constituted a wholly different kind of human game board for this second and more consequential game. The players in this other real game could not be found in the clot of enthusiasts waving their phones at the edge of David's lawn. In the real game, prediction products take the form of protocols that impose forms of telestimulation intended to prod and herd people across real-world terrains to spend their real-world money in the real-world commercial establishments of Niantic's flesh-and-blood behavioral futures markets. Niantic itself is like a tiny probe rising from the immensity of Google's mapping capabilities, surplus flows, means of production, and vast server farms as it constructs and tests the prototype of a global means of behavior modification owned and operated by surveillance capitalism. Niantic discovered that in the rapture of engaging competitive social play, the dreaded friction of individual will voluntarily gives way to game protocols that set the conditions for natural selection. In this way, the game automatically elicits and breeds the specific behaviors sought by the high rollers in Niantic's behavioral futures markets. With this second game board in motion, the players in the real game vie for proximity to the wake of cash that follows each smiling member of the herd. In the end, we recognize that the probe was designed to explore the next frontier, the means of behavioral modification. The game about the game is, in fact, an experimental facsimile of surveillance capitalism's design for our future. It follows the prediction imperative to its logical conclusion, in which data about us in scale and scope combine with actuation mechanisms that align our behavior with a new market cosmos. All the flows of surplus from all the spaces, all the things, all the bodies, all the laughter, and all the tears are finally aimed at this triumph of certain outcomes and the revenue that it can unleash. 4. What were the means of behavioral modification? The new global means of behavioral modification that we see under construction at Facebook and Niantic represent a new regressive age of autonomous capital and heteronomous individuals, when the very possibilities of democratic flourishing and human fulfillment depend upon the reverse. This unprecedented state of affairs rises above debates about the common rule. It goes to the heart of our allegiance to the ideals of a democratic society, with full knowledge of the challenges that burden those ideals. What has been forgotten here is that the common rule was the product of a similar challenge to principles of individual autonomy and democratic fidelity. It was one result of a deeply contested struggle in which democratically minded public officials joined with social activists, scholars, and litigators to resist the design, development, and deployment of behavioral modification as a mode of governmental power. It was not long ago that U.S. society mobilized to resist, regulate, and control the means of behavioral modification. And it is this history that we can now draw upon to rediscover our bearings and rouse our awareness. In 1971, the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, led by North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin, and including luminaries from across the political spectrum, such as Edward Kennedy, Birch Bayh, Robert Byrd, and Strom Thurmond, undertook what would become a multi-year investigation into a variety of programs designed to predict, control, and modify human behavior. Ervin was a conservative Democrat and constitutional expert who became an unlikely civil liberties hero for his defense of democracy during the Watergate crisis as chair of the Senate Watergate Committee. In this case, the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights would subject the principles and applications of behavior modification to intense constitutional scrutiny for the first time, questioning and ultimately rejecting the use of behavioral modification as an extension of state power. The Senate investigation was triggered by a growing sense of public alarm at the spread of psychological techniques for behavior control. There were many points of origin, but most salient was the influence of the Cold War and the range of psychological techniques and programs for behavior modification that it had bred. The Korean War had publicized communist brainwashing techniques that, according to then newly appointed CIA Director Alan Dulles, had reduced U.S. prisoners of war to a state of robotic passivity, in which the victim's brain becomes a phonograph playing a disc put on its spindle by an outside genius over which it has no control. America's enemies appeared to be on the verge of mastering the art and science of mind control with psychological and pharmacological methods unknown to the U.S. military. There were reports of Chinese and Soviet achievements in the remote alteration of a subject's mental capacities and the elimination of his free will. Dulles committed the agency to rapid research in and development of mind control capabilities, from depatterning and rewiring an individual to shaping an entire country's attitudes and actions. Thus began a morbidly fascinating and often bizarre chapter in the history of American spycraft. Much of the new work was conducted in the context of the CIA's highly classified MKUltra project, which was tasked with research and development of chemical, biological, and radiological materials capable for employment in clandestine operations to control human behavior. According to testimony in the 1975 Senate investigation of covert CIA foreign and military intelligence operations, a 1963 Inspector General's report on MKUltra noted several reasons for the program's secrecy, but chief among them was the fact that behavior modification was seen as illegitimate. Research in the manipulation of human behavior is considered by many authorities in medicine and related fields to be professionally unethical. Therefore, the reputation of professional participants in the MKUltra program are on occasion in jeopardy, the report began. It also noted that many of the program's activities were illegal, violated the rights and interests of U.S. citizens, and would alienate public opinion. Key to our interests is the growth and elaboration of behavioral modification as an extension of political power. To this end, CIA demand summoned an ever more audacious supply of behavioral modification research and practical applications from academic psychologists. Scientists from the fields of medicine and psychology set out to demystify Chinese brainwashing techniques, reinterpreting them through the established frameworks of behavior modification. Their research concluded that mind control was better understood as a complex system of conditioning based on unpredictable schedules of reinforcement, consistent with B.F. Skinner's important discoveries on operant conditioning. According to Harvard historian Rebecca Limov, the mind control researchers had a powerful effect on the CIA and other branches of the military. The notion that human material was changeable, that one's personality, identity, awareness, and capacity for self-determining behavior could be crushed, eliminated, and replaced by external control, incited a new sense of panic and vulnerability. If indeed the world was rife with threats to the inner as much as the outer man, then experts in these realms were needed more than ever. Many good and well-meaning professors, self-described or de facto human engineers, participated in the CIA's programs to bring about slow or rapid change in the minds and behavior of people. By the time the senators on the Constitutional Rights Subcommittee convened in 1971, the migration of behavior modification practices from military to civilian applications were well underway. Behavior modification techniques had dispersed from government-funded, typically CIA, psychology labs, and military psyops, to a range of institutional applications, each driven by a mission to re-engineer the defective personalities of captive individuals in settings that offered total control, or close to it, including prisons, psychiatric wards, classrooms, institutions for the mentally challenged, schools for the autistic, and factories. The subcommittee was emboldened to act when public concern bubbled over into outrage at the mainstreaming of these behavior modification programs. Historian of psychology Alexandra Rutherford observes that Skinnerian behavior modification practices expanded rapidly during the 1960s and 1970s, achieving some remarkable successes, but also exposing practitioners to the scrutiny of an often hostile public. A number of journalistic accounts raised alarms about the zealousness with which behavior modification techniques were applied, and the sense that they debased their subjects, violated ethical considerations, and infringed on fundamental civil liberties. Another factor was the 1971 publication of B.F. Skinner's incendiary social meditation, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Skinner prescribed a future based on behavioral control, rejecting the very idea of freedom as well as every tenet of a liberal society, and cast the notion of human dignity as an accident of self-serving narcissism. Skinner imagined a pervasive technology of behavior that would one day enable the application of behavior modification methods across entire human populations. The ensuing storm of controversy made Beyond Freedom and Dignity an international bestseller. Skinner's science of human behavior, being quite vacuous, is as congenial to the libertarian as to the fascist, wrote Noam Chomsky in a widely read review of the book. It would be not absurd, but grotesque to argue that since circumstances can be arranged under which behavior is quite predictable, as in a prison, for example, or concentration camp, therefore there need be no concern for the freedom and dignity of autonomous man. In the mid-1970s graduate department at Harvard, where I studied and Skinner professed, many students referred to the book as Toward Slavery and Humiliation. From the first lines of the preface of the subcommittee's 1974 report, authored by Senator Ervin, it should be evident to any 21st century captive of surveillance capitalism that U.S. society has undergone a social discontinuity more profound than the mere passage of decades suggests. It is worth reading Ervin's own words to grasp the passion with which he located the subcommittee's work at the heart of the Enlightenment Project, pledging to defend the liberal ideas of freedom and dignity. When the Founding Fathers established our constitutional system of government, they based it on their fundamental belief in the sanctity of the individual. They understood that self-determination is the source of individuality, and individuality is the mainstay of freedom. Recently, however, technology has begun to develop new methods of behavior control, capable of altering not just an individual's actions, but his very personality and manner of thinking. The behavioral technology being developed in the United States today touches upon the most basic sources of individuality and the very core of personal freedom. The most serious threat is the power this technology gives one man to impose his views and values on another. Concepts of freedom, privacy, and self-determination inherently conflict with programs designed to control not just physical freedom, but the source of free thought as well. The question becomes even more acute when these programs are conducted, as they are today, in the absence of strict controls. As disturbing as behavior modification may be on a theoretical level, the unchecked growth of the practical technology of behavior control is cause for even greater concern. The report's critique of behavior modification has unique relevance for our time. It begins by asking a question that we must also ask. How did they get away with it? Their answer invokes the exceptionalism of that era. Just as surveillance capitalism was initially able to root and flourish under the protection of a so-called war against terror and the compulsion for certainty that it stirred, in the middle of the 20th century, the means of behavioral modification migrated from the lab to the world at large, primarily under the cover of Cold War anxieties. Later, the behavior change professionals of the 1960s and 1970s were summoned into civilian practice by a society turned fearful after years of urban riots, political protests, and rising levels of crime and delinquency. The senators reasoned that calls for law and order had motivated the search for immediate and efficient means to control violence and other forms of antisocial behavior. The interest in controlling violence replaced more time-consuming attempts to understand its sources. With so many behavior modification programs aimed at involuntary populations in state prisons and mental institutions, the senators recognized that the means of behavioral modification had to be reckoned with as a form of state power and questioned the government's constitutional right to control citizens' behavior and mentation. In its survey of government agencies, the subcommittee found a wide variety of behavior modification techniques presently employed in the United States under the auspices of the federal government, and observed that, with the rapid proliferation of behavior modification techniques, It is all the more disturbing that few real efforts have been made to consider the basic issues of individual freedom involved and fundamental conflicts between individual rights and behavior technology. The senators reserved their most vivid rebukes for what they considered as the two most extreme and pernicious behavior modification techniques. The first was psychosurgery. The second was electrophysiology, defined as the use of mechanical devices to control various aspects of human behavior. The report notes with special horror the example of devices designed to be worn by a subject constantly to monitor and control his behavior through a computer and to prevent a suspected behavior from occurring. The First Amendment, the subcommittee argued, must equally protect the individual's right to generate ideas, and the right to privacy should protect citizens from intrusions into their thoughts, behavior, personality, and identity, lest these concepts become meaningless. It was in this context that Skinnerian behavioral engineering was singled out for critical examination. A major segment of the emerging behavior control technology is concerned with conditioning, through which various forms of persuasion are used to stimulate certain types of behaviors while suppressing others. In anticipation of future gamification techniques as means of behavioral modification, the subcommittee report also noted with apprehension more benign approaches that relied on positive reinforcement, from Gold Star incentives to elaborate reward systems, in order to restructure personality through artificially applied techniques. The generalized obsession with controlling violence had also produced methods of behavior prediction that raise profound questions with respect to due process, privacy, and individual liberties. A psychologist writing in the American Psychological Association's journal Monitor in 1974 sounded the alert, warning colleagues who touted their ability to control behavior that they were now viewed with increasing suspicion, if not revulsion, and threatened with restriction. The social control of behavior control is underway. The subcommittee's work had enduring consequences. Not only did prisoners and patients' rights groups gain momentum in their efforts to end the behavioral oppression suffered in public institutions, but psychologists also began to discuss the need to professionalize their discipline with clear ethical standards, accreditation procedures, training programs, and career ladders. The National Research Act, passed in 1974, stipulated the creation of institutional review boards and laid the foundation for the evolution and institutionalization of the common rule for the ethical treatment of human subjects, from which Facebook famously held itself exempt. That same year, Congress established the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research. When the commission published its findings 5 years later in the Belmont Report, it became the professional standard for imposing ethical guidelines on all federally funded research with human subjects in the U.S. The clamorous rights consciousness of the 1970s drove behavior modification from civilian life, or at least dimmed its star. A Federal Bureau of Prisons official recommended that program leaders avoid using the term behavioral modification, but to talk about positive reward and reinforcements for the type of behavior we are attempting to instill. Another said, "We're doing what we always did, but to call it behavior modification just makes things more difficult." Skinner's 1976 primer, titled About Behaviorism, motivated by what he believed were public misconceptions stirred by the wave of harsh reaction to Beyond Freedom and Dignity, failed to capture much public attention. According to Skinner's biographer, the battle had climaxed. The public had made Beyond Freedom and Dignity a bestseller, but had just as surely rejected Skinner's argument that there were cultural matters more important than preserving and extending individual freedom. Most fascinating is that throughout these years of anxiety and debate, it was impossible to imagine the means of behavioral modification as anything other than owned and operated by the government, a privileged modality of state power. A 1966 Harvard Law Review article addressed issues of electronic tracking, surveillance, and behavioral control, reasoning that it would consider governmental attempts to change conduct, since these seem more likely than private attempts. The democratic impulse of U.S. society, repelled by the excesses of its intelligence agencies, their support of criminal activities undertaken by the Nixon administration, and the migration of behavior modification as a means of disciplinary control in state institutions, led to the rejection of behavioral modification as an extension of governmental power. Unknown to the senators, scholars, rights activists, legislators, and many other citizens who stood against the anti-democratic incursions of the behavioral engineering vision, these methods had not died. The project would resurface in a wholly unexpected incarnation as a creature of the market, its unprecedented digital capabilities, scale, and scope now flourishing under the flag of surveillance capitalism. During the same years that U.S. democratic forces combined to resist behavior modification as a form of state power, the energies of capitalist counterinsurgency were already at work within society. The corporation was to enjoy the rights of personhood, but be free of democratic obligations, legal constraints, moral calculations, and social considerations. Certainly, in the U.S. case, a weakened state in which elected officials depended upon corporate wealth in every election cycle has shown little appetite to contest behavior modification as a market project, let alone to stand for the moral imperatives of the autonomous individual. In its latest incarnation, behavioral modification comes to life as a global digital market architecture, unfettered by geography, independent of constitutional constraints, and formally indifferent to the risks it poses to freedom, dignity, or the sustenance of the liberal order that Irvin's subcommittee was determined to defend. This contrast is even more distressing in light of the fact that in the mid-20th century, the means of behavior modification were aimed at individuals and groups who were construed as them. Military enemies, prisoners, and other captives of walled disciplinary regimes. Today's means of behavioral modification are aimed unabashedly at us. Everyone is swept up in this new market dragnet, including the psychodramas of ordinary, unsuspecting 14-year-olds approaching the weekend with anxiety. Every avenue of connectivity serves to bolster private power's need to seize behavior for profit. Where is the hammer of democracy now, when the threat comes from your phone, your digital assistant, your Facebook login? Who will stand for freedom now, when Facebook threatens to retreat into the shadows if we dare to be the friction that disrupts economies of action that have been carefully, elaborately, and expensively constructed to exploit our natural empathy, elude our awareness, and circumvent our prospects for self-determination? If we fail to take notice now, how long before we are numb to this incursion and to all the incursions? How long until we notice nothing at all? How long before we forget who we were before they owned us, bent over the old texts of self-determination in the dim light, the shawl around our shoulders, magnifying glass in hand, as if deciphering ancient hieroglyphs? Throughout these chapters, we have returned to the essential questions that define the division of learning. Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? As to who knows, we have seen the titanic agglomerations of knowledge about our behavior in the shadow text, from vast patterns across populations to the intimate detail of individual lives. These new information territories are private and privileged, known only to the machines, their priests, and the market participants who pay to play in these new spaces. Although it is obviously the case that we are excluded because the knowledge is not for us, these chapters have revealed a deeper structural basis for our exclusion. Now we know that surveillance capitalists' ability to evade our awareness is an essential condition for knowledge production. We are excluded because we are friction that impedes the elaboration of the shadow text, and with it, surveillance capitalism's knowledge dominance. As to who decides, this division of learning has been decided by the declarations and incursions of the owners of private surveillance capital as another essential condition of accumulation, enabled by the reluctance of the state to assert democratic oversight in this secret realm. Finally, there is the question of who decides who decides. So far, it is the asymmetrical power of surveillance capital, unencumbered by law, that decides who decides. The commodification of behavior under the conditions of surveillance capitalism pivots us toward a societal future in which an exclusive division of learning is protected by secrecy, indecipherability, and expertise. Even when knowledge derived from your behavior is fed back to you in the first text as a quid pro quo for participation, the parallel secret operations of the shadow text capture surplus for crafting into prediction products destined for other marketplaces that are about you rather than for you. These markets do not depend upon you except first as a source of raw material from which surplus is derived, and then as a target for guaranteed outcomes. We have no formal control because we are not essential to the market action. In this future, we are exiles from our own behavior, denied access to or control over knowledge derived from our experience. Knowledge, authority, and power rest with surveillance capital, for which we are merely human natural resources.